Jonathan Franzen's 2001 novel, The Corrections, won the National Book Award, and Freedom was named one of the best books of 2010 by Time, the New York Times Book Review, and Publishers Weekly, among others. But for this month's book club, we are going back to Mr. Franzen's first novel, The 27th City, which was published in 1988, and it was set in his hometown, St. Louis. In it, St. Louis is a quietly dying city until it hires a charismatic but corrupt young woman from Bombay, India, as its new police chief. A new 25th anniversary edition of the novel has been published by Picador. Also recently from Mr. Franzen is The Kraus Project, translations of the Viennese critic and satirist Karl Kraus, and that's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I'm very pleased to welcome Jonathan Franzen back to our show. Hello.
Lovely to be here.
And then we invite our listeners, especially the ones who've been reading 27 City, along with us to call in. You can leave your comments on our show page at WNYC.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. This was your first published novel. Was it the first novel you wrote?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I started this came out of a playwriting workshop I took in college. We had to write fresh scenes every week, and I came in with like five ready-made, and then I was out of them, and brought in some characters from a play I'd written with some friends after my first year in college, and I just brought these Indians into a St. Louis kitchen and thought, you know, this might be a novel, and I worked on it for, yeah, then it was like 8 years before I finished it.
So did you see yourself initially as potential playwright or a novelist?
Started out with an interest in theater. And in fact, the very first thing I published was a short play that I'd written with a friend in high school. You had to be around theater people to be a playwright.
Well, in this case, you've written a work of speculative fiction. Did that end by the time you had written the corrections?
Yeah, there was kind of a break. My first two novels, you couldn't. If something as dramatic as a conspiracy to take over St. Louis, Missouri, on the part of a bunch of fresh immigrants were to happen, or the second novel, if a major earthquake were to seriously damage Boston, you'd know about it. And so when you're reading those books, you feel that these don't fit into the grain of the world as we know it. And since then, I've taken more care to fit the fiction into the grain of the world.
But speculative fiction is often using the near future to talk about the present. And you were doing that here, weren't you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the book is ostensibly set in 1984, somewhat randomly chosen because early on, Indira Gandhi is still alive, and then she dies, and she died in 1984. So the book kind of had to be set in 1984, and there, of course, was the Orwellian echo to that. And by the time it came out, that was 4 years in the past. So it was, you know, 1984 still feels like the future to us even now, 30 years later, because it was the future to George Orwell.
It's kind of complicated plot involving infiltration, terrorism, real estate development. But there's also a family with a teenage daughter who leaves home to move in with her new boyfriend. And that's a similar situation to Freedom.
You know, that had not occurred to me. That's true enough, yes. I was somebody who came from a good, loving, stable home and who, when I got to be 17, 18, needed to leave just in the worst way. And so, maybe that's a fixture, actually, of all of my books, the mid to late adolescent who has to get away.
And Louisa, the teenager in the book, is interested in bird watching. Now, we've talked about your interest in bird watching, but I didn't realize it dated back that far.
I wasn't interested in bird watching. It happened that I came, you know, much of the book is set in Webster Groves, Missouri, which is a suburb of St. Louis where I grew up. And it happened that the greatest bird watcher in the world was the mom of some friends of mine all through junior high and high school. And a number of friends of mine fell under her spell and were bird watchers, so I knew a little bit about it. But I myself never trained a pair of binoculars on birds at that age.
And then you have a character, Martin Probst, who helped build the St. Louis Arch.
He did build the St. Louis Arch.
Oh, this was based on a real person.
No. Well, I mean, yeah, somebody obviously did, but he was the contractor who put the thing up.
Do you see him as having any similarities to Walter Berglund from Freedom?
Another good question. I appreciate that, Lenny.
Well, I think that it's obvious that certain things are important to writers, and they pop up again and again, even if they're not always aware of it.
You know, the figure of my father looms large in my imagination, and he was a very, very honest, upright person, with a really, really stringent moral code, which went so far that he thought it was unethical to have a drink at home before you went to a restaurant, because so much of restaurant profits come from drink sales, and he thought it wasn't fair to the restaurant. I mean, that was the kind of man I grew up with. And
that must have been tough.
You know, yes and no. As a rebellious teenager in the 70s, yes, that was part of why I needed to get away. And of course, and by comparison, you know, I felt like a lying, thieving, messed up kid. But in the fullness of time, I came to appreciate that. And yeah, that becomes an archetype that recurs in all the books, really, that morally stringent, honest father figure.
I'm talking with Jonathan Franzen on the about the 25th anniversary edition of his first published novel, in fact, his first novel, The 27th City, now available from Picador. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about it and some of the other books. Coming up in our second hour, Tim Cope talks about the challenges he faced when he followed the trail of Genghis Khan. Plus, science writer Carl Zimmern describes the fastest evolving places on Earth. I hope you can join me in the green space tonight at 6:30 when I'll be hosting game night for singles 40 and over. Enjoy snacks, drinks, and your favorite board games while you meet new people. There are still tickets available for men and women. For more information, visit WNYC.org/events, and I hope to see you there. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC is supported by Kupferberg Center for the Arts at Queens College. Kupferberg presents the Boston Pops Grand 75-piece orchestra and 60-person chorus, performing holiday favorites Sunday, December 8th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more at kupferbergpresents.org. The New York Community Trust. The trust works with generous donors to make New York an even better place to call home. More information at nycommunitytrust.org. Blue School, an independent school located in downtown Manhattan, where curriculum is designed to promote discovery, investigation, and creativity. Now accepting applications for 2-year-olds through 5th grade. Information on weekly tours at blueschool.org.
Women have no patience for men who play games, except for Pictionary, Scrabble, and Monopoly. Join us, gentlemen, for game night in the green space, for single New Yorkers 40 and over. Come mingle, enjoy snacks and drinks, and meet new people while playing your favorite board games. Tonight at 6:30. Purchase tickets at wnyc.org/events.
We're back with Jonathan Franzen, who's the author of 4 novels, including Freedom, National Book Award winning The Corrections, and Strong Motion, A Personal History, The Discomfort Zone. That was the personal history. 2 collections of essays, Farther Away and How to Be Alone, translations of Frank Wedekind's Spring Awakening and Karl Kraus's essays under the title The Kraus Project. The book we are discussing is his first novel, The 27th City, which has just been made available from Picador in their Modern Classics series as on the 25th anniversary of its publication. How was it received when it was first published?
Generally, quite warmly. Although the two venues for reviews that mattered most to me were problematic. The New York Times Book Review reviewed it as a crime novel, which I guess in a sense it is. And Terrence Rafferty in The New Yorker, after by all appearances reading no more than 25 pages of it, wrote about 8 columns about what a bad person I was. I would say mixed in my view, but, you know, there are plenty of quotes to put on the book.
Well, when you reread it, I'm assuming you've reread it, were you pleased?
You know, this is the opportunity to say that, yes, it's 25 years since it came out, and to stress that I was quite young when it came out, and even younger when I wrote it. You know, I won't sit down and read a book of my own cover to cover. I did dip in preparation for coming here, and you spend your life as a writer trying to get better, and so it's very hard not to, excuse me, look at the book and see almost sentence by sentence what I would have done differently.
On the other hand, I'm sure there were a few that you said, gee, that was pretty good.
That's right. I can see how hard and to some extent successfully I was trying to appear as if I knew everything.
Well, the threat of terrorism, corruption, surveillance in this book are topics that seem to be almost better suited to today rather than the 1980s. Or have I been too kind on the 1980s?
No, it was there. I've said when 9/11 happened, you know, Don DeLillo has been writing about 9/11 since about 1979. I don't know why conspiracy so appealed to me. I think it came partly out of all of the science fiction I read as a teenager. And I was riveted by the Watergate hearings and Nixon's resignation and all that came out about that conspiracy in a little bit earlier. So, and I think I was also very taken with the movie Cutter's Way, Ivan Passer's movie, which is very much about a kind of a corporate conspiracy with a very dark ending. So the late 70s had curdled into a lot of conspiratorial thinking. So it didn't seem that strange to me at the time. The terrorism and the external threat, that was my own weird contribution.
I read that David Foster Wallace wrote to you after he read The 27th City. Was that how you were first introduced?
That is.
Was he well-known at the time?
He had published The Broom of the System the year before, and my editor had sent him a copy of The 27th City, advance copy, and he wrote this incredibly lovely letter back, but his postcard with a blurb had been lost, and I think he was very hurt that his blurb wasn't on the book. What was not to like about a guy writing to say how much he loved the book? So we got to be friends.
And you obviously exchanged ideas. Is that, you think, all that common, writers helping each other in that way? Usually it's writers with their editors.
Well.
Or their spouses.
Yes. I had a spouse who was a writer, and she was really the primary editor on this book. You know, she was in the trenches with me for 5 years when I was writing it in my early 20s. Dave came along a little later, and there were conversations that we were having about why would you bother being a fiction writer in this incredibly media-saturated age that I think only could be worked out peer-to-peer. You know, you're going to go talk to your editor? Well, he's got his fall list, and then he'll have his spring list, and then he'll have his fall list. You know, there is no asking that question. But if you were 28, 29, wondering, why am I going to pursue this for the rest of my life, finding somebody else who saw the world very similarly, worried about exactly the same things, that's how we started out as friends.
Freedom is a lot about how to be a good person, a good spouse, parent, citizen, environmentalist, friend. But that it's hard and perhaps even impossible. In The 27th City, there are people who are trying to be bad, like the corrupt police chief, Jammu, and her henchmen, but others, especially Martin Probst, do try to be good. Is this a central question that you find yourself asking when you're working?
You know, it goes back to what I was saying about growing up feeling like the morally dubious son of a morally beyond question father. And absolutely, I identified with the Indians, their sense of having landed in this strange place and being both...
Being St. Louis.
Being St. Louis, yeah. They were working their way into the fabric of everyday life, and yet they were aliens. And by the time I was had been away from St. Louis for some years, it was still, you know, in every pore of my body, and yet I felt so alienated from it. I did bring that sense of distance and also moral dubiety to the project, and they're a somewhat Earl Franzen-like figure towering over it.
Do you think of the Midwest as distinct from the rest of the country?
You know, I used to, and somebody, a presenter on a BBC radio show, challenged me to define what Midwestern was, and I found that it was impossible to define. I was describing Australia. I was describing Georgia. It was really, you know, the concept crumbles when you try to do anything with it.
We've invited our listeners to read the book along with us and ask questions on our show page. Brian A. from Edison, New Jersey asks, Jonathan, you've written effusively about Alice Munro. In an essay a few years ago, you chided the Nobel Committee for not giving her a Nobel. What was your reaction when you found out that that the Nobels had finally listened to your plea?
Well, I wouldn't give myself credit for that, but jubilation. It was literally the best news of 2013. I'm still kind of floating around with that news. It's great.
I always wondered why she didn't get it sooner, and I guess it's because she was a short story writer.
Strange, though, given that she's the first, to my knowledge, she's the first pure short story writer ever to get the Nobel Prize, also the first Canadian to get it in literature. It seemed like a no-brainer. What more do you need? She's also the best fiction writer in North America. I mean,
although she's just quit, sadly.
Well, she's not well, from what I hear.
You've also just published The Krauss Project, translations of the essays of the Viennese satirist Karl Krauss. Can you talk about his writing and his influence?
Yes. Well, I have this strange book out in hardcover right now, in which I go back to some translations I began working on around the time I was starting The 27th City, when I was a very angry and alienated young person. And Krauss was exactly what I was looking for. He was this apocalyptic satirist who really never met a thing in the modern world that he didn't have a strong opinion about, mostly negative. And at a certain point, I outgrew him. And then at a certain point, I began to feel, you know, his time is only coming now, because he was the first great media critic, media tech critic. And when I went back with the urging of some friends of mine who are Krauss fans and looked at him again, I realized, you know, he's really talking about 2013.
Well, there was an essay in The New Yorker recently about how people don't know how to be bored anymore and can't seem to be without constant stimulation from the media, and that this has been a concern since long before television was invented. Do you think writers worry about this more than other people?
Well, I think writers are supposed to worry about everything more than other people. It's kind of our job. We are the canaries in the coal mine. It's interesting. If you go back to Kierkegaard, he had this notion of the busy person and of busyness as a defense from actually taking a full accounting, a moral accounting of yourself. And there's so much that's disturbing in the world that really the way not to think about it is to be busy, electronically busy, every waking minute.
Well, not just Kierkegaard. The comedian Louis C.K. talks about how people are afraid to be alone with their thoughts and to feel any emotions, especially sadness. So
Tim Kreider, too, also in a piece in the Times not long ago, just really the tyranny of busyness and the way that that actually serves to as a defense against emotion, yeah.
Just one more thing. Listener David asks, do you know the endings of your books when you start writing them?
Maybe not right up front, but and how to get to the ending is what makes it exciting to try to finish a book, because I never know. But I have some, yeah, the ending is fairly clear before much of the middle is.
Mm-hmm. So as you're writing it, you see where you're moving toward, and then...
You set yourself a distant and impossible to achieve goal. And for me, speaking of boredom, that helps keep me focused on... it makes it an exciting project to try to reach that ending.
I'm assuming there's another novel in the works.
Yes.
Meanwhile, we have been talking about Jonathan Franzen's first novel, published 25 years ago, The 27th City, now available in paperback from Picador. There's also the Krauss Project from Farrar, Straus and Giroux, and I'm thankful to Jonathan Franzen for being on today's Leonard Lopate Show Book Club.